I'm happy to have Joseph Bethante here with his wife Joan from North Carolina. I met Joe when I went down to show the Door Is Open Charles Olson at the in Asheville last fall, and he said he was coming up here, so we made sure he had a little stop over in Gloucester. And I know he's interested in going over to the Maude Olson Library. Joseph is a poet, novelist, and professor at Appalachian State University in Boone, North Carolina. And he served as a poet laureate in North Carolina from 2012 to 2014. He was born and raised in Pittsburgh, PA, received his BA and MA in English literature from the University of Pittsburgh, and then an MFA in creative writing from Warren Wilson College. In 1976, he came to North Carolina as a VISTA volunteer to work with prison inmates. And I didn't know until I did a little research for this that he met and befriended Fielding Dawson, the writer, teacher, and painter who came to Black Mountain to study with Franz Kline and Charles Olson. So that's kind of a nice little intersection here with Gloucester. So I hope we hear a little more about that this evening. Joseph is the author of 8 books of poetry, a handful of novels and nonfiction. His novel Coventry, the saga of a father and son set in a southern prison, won the Novello Literary Award, and his collection of personal essays, Half of What I Say is Meaningless, earned the Will D. Campbell Award for Creative Nonfiction. He's a recipient of 2 literature fellowships from North Carolina Arts Council, Samuel Talmadge Reagan Award, a fellowship from Witterbinder Foundation for Poetry, and the Bruno Arcudi Literature Prize. How's my pronunciation there, Paul? I think it's all right.
Can't read it.
So it's Bruno. I got down A-R-C-U-D-I, Arcudi. C-U-D-I, yeah.
Italian?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And Aniello Laurie Award for Creative Writing, the Sherwood Anderson Award, and many others. He's professor of creative writing at Appalachia State University, and he lives with his wife, Joan, in Vilas, North Carolina, and his 2 kids. So there we go.
Thanks.
Joe.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming.
My pleasure.
This is just for the...
Sure. Yeah, and I'll project.
Right.
Yeah, thank you all for being here. I'm gonna start with a poem of mine and end with a poem of mine. In between, I'm gonna read an essay about just Black Mountain College and how I got introduced to it and just kind of my journey with it, if you will. Henry mentioned that Joan and I met in 1976 as VISTA volunteers. Joan's from Atlanta, I'm from Pittsburgh, and I'd gotten out of grad school and didn't know what I wanted to do, but had a really long, long list of things I couldn't stomach the thought of doing, so I just threw my name in the hat and was assigned to the North Carolina Department of Correction, and Joan had a similar story, to tell you the truth. She had just finished college, and so we were assigned to the same project and met the very first day of training and got married the next day. So,
almost.
Close. So this poem's called The Foot Locker. So my whole family, all my grandparents immigrated from Italy, actually one from France in the first decade of the 20th century. I'm the first person with my name to go to college, so it's a really big deal. I'm first generation college, and not only do I graduate from college, but I get a master's degree. And all the Italian women on the block, there were 2 occupations a son could have. One was a doctor, one was a lawyer. And so I get this lofty degree, and I decide to leave home, go 500 miles away and work with criminals for $2,000 a year. So they were pretty mystified at that. And my dad wanted to buy me a footlocker to take all the stuff I'd be taking with me. So this is just a poem called The Footlocker. And I think the poem kind of explains itself. the Foot Locker. The day before I left Pittsburgh to work as a Vista volunteer in the prisons of North Carolina, my father drove me in the family car, an enormous two-door green Chrysler Newport, downtown to the Army-Navy store on Liberty Avenue. He was set on buying me a Foot Locker, something I had never dreamt of possessing. He and my mother were befuddled as to why I, having recently earned a master's degree, wished to spend my days among criminals 500 miles from home for $2,000 a year. They had little faith in my car, beat up 69 VW Bug with no reverse. My mother wept. My father said nothing. In my recollection, he has never attempted to dissuade me from anything, nor made public his desires. Two things for which I can't begin to express my gratitude. I didn't want a Foot Locker, but couldn't bring myself to tell him. We wandered the store looking at switchblades, gas masks, live grenades, then purchased the Foot Locker. My dad wanted to get me something else. Realizing a refusal would be unkind, I picked out a denim cowboy shirt with pearl buttons. At the time, a real stretch for me, but in 24 hours, I'd walk away from my past. Style seemed irrelevant. Next door to the Army-Navy sprawled a string of porno shops. Once I snuck into one with a friend. We squeezed into a booth and watched a 25-cent black and white clip, then gaped at magazine jackets, contraptions, and novelties that belonged in a laboratory. A black curtain through which men passed in and out led to a back room. Such experiences, I'm certain, are not unusual among boys, yet standing that day on Liberty Avenue with my father, I was filled not with shame, but regret, because I was leaving and glad about it. I didn't require absolution, but I longed to tell him about slipping into that dive for all I knew. And I realize now how little I know about the inside of my father. He too had been in one of those places before, but it was painful thinking about having something like this in common with my dad, and I valued above all else, and I think he did too, that we never spoke of such things. I was 23 years old, and that fact, in the line of men I issued from, entitled me to silence. My father and I climbed back into the Chrysler and drove home to my mother, and the last supper we would ever eat together on that still green side of my life. The next morning, I picked up I-79 and headed south. In the back seat of my car lay the Foot Locker, which I still own and use to store old manuscripts, notebooks, and letters that in all likelihood I'll never return to. And now I'm gonna read a piece that's called really My Black Mountain. It's not really titled the way I want it to, but it's something I've read a number of times. It's currently unpublished, I think. I sort of can't remember, to tell you the truth. And I'm wondering, so this is the town, of course, of the famous Charles Olson, who was at Black Mountain for just a little while. 1948-49, left, came back in 1951, and was there until the college closed. He actually was in charge of the college, of liquidating the college. It was an experimental college between 1933 and 1957. He was its last rector. He took that over in 53. So under his tutelage and leadership, the college launched, you know, it's really notable, terrifically famous literature and writing program. And out of that, the School of Black Mountain Poetry came, which is still a very vibrant and influential school. So I'm wondering, do folks here know much about the college? I know you know who Olson is. It's impossible not to if you live in Gloucester. But so it doesn't matter. I'm gonna just tell you how I got involved. And then if there's time after, I'm glad to answer questions, too. And any discussion that ensues. And it starts out, the history of Black Mountain College is called Black Mountain, An Exploration in Community by Martin Duberman. It came out in 1972. There's also a really important book by Mary Emma Harris called The Arts at Black Mountain College that I think came out around maybe 85 or 86. But Duberman's the book to read if you were going to read one. And so this essay starts with this epigraph. It, meaning Black Mountain College, was the forerunner and exemplar of much that is currently considered innovative in art, education, and lifestyle. My intoxication with Black Mountain College began the summer of 1987 when Ronald H. Bays, my literary godfather, laid in my hands Martin Duberman's Black Mountain, An Exploration in Community. I just started teaching at then St. Andrews Presbyterian College in Laurinburg, North Carolina, a little town every bit as obscured as the town of Black Mountain back in 1933, when the first faculty members of Black Mountain College arrived at the rail station on Sutton Avenue and were spirited off to their new home at the Blue Ridge Assembly in the very rural Swannanoa Valley. Ron, longtime distinguished professor and writer in residence at St. Andrews, an unapologetic Poundian, and by my lights, a fringe Black Mountain poet himself, had been intimates with Black Mountain writers Charles Olson, Ed Dorn, Jonathan Williams, Joel Oppenheimer, Fielding Dawson, and a very close friend of Robert Creeley until Creeley's death. Through Ron's magical connections, many of those writers had been frequent visitors to the St. Andrews campus. In a 1974, St. Andrews hosted the now mythic, actually unimaginable, so large are the names on this list, Black Mountain Festival that featured the writers already mentioned, other than Olson, as well as John Cage, Merce Cunningham, Buckminster Fuller, and M.C. Richards. At the time I read Duberman's book, I had merely heard of Black Mountain College, which I knew no longer existed. I conceived of it like any other college, like the ones I attended and taught at. As I read, however, I was astonished to learn page by page what experimental education and community looked like up close. Perhaps in truth, what education and community had been meant to aspire to all along. What's more, I was utterly mystified as to why I, having been a North Carolinian and a college English professor for 10 years, and pretty knowledgeable, or so I thought, in American literature, Black Mountain College had never crossed my radar. Today, 31 years after I discovered Black Mountain, it remains among even the well-educated across America, not to mention the citizens of North Carolina, at best an anomaly, but more a well-kept secret. Indeed, there's nothing to commemorate its considerable glory other than a terse epitaph etched into a silver historical marker on U.S. Highway 70 at West College Street. It says, Black Mountain College, established in 1933, closed 1957, experimental school with emphasis on fine arts and progressive education. Campus was 3 miles northwest. In early 1933, John Andrew Rice, an outspoken firebrand professor at Rollins College in Winter Park, Florida, was dismissed from his teaching post by Rollins president Hamilton Holt. Rice had been accused of many things, chief among them fomenting revolt among the Rollins faculty. Rice held the traditional lockstep academia, and its often neurasthenic curricula allowed little in the way of independent thought and engagement in the pluralistic tradition of John Dewey, the holistic conflation of living and intellect. Consequently, Rice had led a band of fellow academic dissidents from Rollins, as well as a number of Rollins students loyal to him, and ended up founding Black Mountain College deep in the mountains of North Carolina's Buncombe County. In his quest to start a new college, Rice had nothing in the way of the plan, much less dollars or even a building. America was in the early throes of the Great Depression. Europe was entering the cataclysmic swoon that eventually resulted in Hitler's takeover of Czechoslovakia. Modernism, a key progenitor of Black Mountain College, was in full tilt, charting in breathtaking but often inscrutable media the blasted fragments of World War I. The college's very first catalog stated that it had been founded to provide a place where free use might be made of tested, improved methods of education and new methods tried in a purely experimental spirit. The W.L. Urey Appalachian Collection in the Belk Library at Appalachian State University, where I teach, houses the John Andrew Rice papers, an incredible trove of lore and memorabilia. One extraordinary document, tattered, cracked, and with Rice's own penned-in emendations, is a single page to page of aged onion skin. At its crest, the heading, in all caps, "The Purpose of the College." It begins, "The purpose of the college is to lead on to creative consciousness a carefully selected group of talented young men and young women who are eager to know, to will, and to do. The medium for the development of broad-minded personality, which can function cooperatively, are the subjects taught and the activities fostered by the college." Toward the bottom of the page is an epigraph from St. Paul, 1 Corinthians 8:1. "As to knowledge, we all have knowledge. Knowledge puffeth up, but charity edifieth." Across its very bottom edge, in Rice's penmanship, sprawls inner freedom in judgment and action. That first semester, fall of 1933, Black Mountain College was comprised of 13 faculty members and 26 students. The physical plant materialized like so many of Black Mountain's milestones through serendipity. One of Rice's confederates, Bob Wunsch, the dramatist from Rollins, not incidentally the roommate of Thomas Wolfe for a time at the University of North Carolina, suggested the first site for Black Mountain College. The Blue Ridge Assembly, a Christian conference and training center established in 1906, was a cluster of buildings, including the august antebellum Robert E. Lee Hall. It was utilized in the summer for religious retreats, but unused for the most part during the traditional academic year. Rice and Wunsch engineered a deal and were able to rent the Blue Ridge Assembly for a fantastic bargain. Nevertheless, there was a depression to contend with. There was little money. In fact, the dependable operating budget remained a crucial issue year to year for the life of the college. Mac Forbes of the famous Forbes family, a former Rollins professor himself, rode out of the West and underwrote the majority of those early startup costs. Black Mountain College faculty, with liberal input from the students, ran the entire operation proprietarily and administratively. No boards of regents, directors, or trustees. The college was not accredited. Of the roughly 1,200 students who attended it during its history, few, approximately 60, ever graduated. And those who did received hand-designed, homemade diplomas. Yet Black Mountain students, upon leaving, were coveted by the very best graduate schools in America and beyond. The school's structure was its lack of structure. The pedagogical direction was whatever students and teachers agreed upon. No grades, no sports teams, process claimed dominion over product. While a number of Buncombe County residents ended up attending concerts, lectures, and plays at the college, and there were other intersections between Black Mountain and the surrounding local community, the overall impression one gets, whether myth or fact, is that the college was regarded by locals with suspicion and disdain, a haven of perdition. As Jonathan Williams put it, "If you considered free love, communism, and nigger loving to your taste, Black Mountain was the place to go." And one always likes to go to a college that would offend one's parents. Faculty were paid on the basis of individual need. When there were surplus funds, they received a small salary, as well as room and board. During those times when funds did not exist to pay entire salaries, that deficit was logged as a debt against the college at the end of the year. Much of the food that fed the residents was grown on the college farm. Self-sufficiency, living lean and close to the land and the true pioneering tradition of America was very much a part of Black Mountain. The college taught that the exchange of creature comfort for freedom was more than an equitable barter. Black Mountain invented itself and in so doing established a paradigm for all educational communities ever after to mimic. It initiated itself by posing tough questions about arbitrary traditional rules governing education and teaching, questions about the self, and various external fetters imposed upon it. Black Mountain was also a crucible of dangerously volatile social change. Long before the rest of America, especially institutionalized America, wrestled with sexual orientation and racial integration, Black Mountain was establishing a forum for discussion and acceptance, but always, and perhaps more importantly, dissent. During its inception, it became a sanctuary for Jewish intellectuals, many of whom were forced to leave the Bauhaus when Hitler shut it down, fleeing the scourge of Nazi Europe. In 1988, I took a job under the auspices of the North Carolina Visiting Artist Program as writer-in-residence at McDowell Technical Community College in Marion, North Carolina. My wife, Joan, and our one-year-old son, Jacob, moved to Old Fort, an outpost in the far west of McDowell County, literally in the shadow of Black Mountain, a mere 7 miles off, way up corkscrewing Old Fort Mountain. Being in such proximity to the sites of the legendary college enchanted me. I was actually invited to read my work at Blue Ridge Assembly in Lee Hall, no less, in front of the same immense fireplace where Thornton Wilder, 5 years before our town, won the Pulitzer Prize, mesmerized Black Mountain College. I wandered the endless corridors, the voluminous rooms and sequestered chambers with the same furniture the Black Mountaineers had used, the same oxygen they had breathed still secreted in the ether. I wrapped my arms around the colossal white columns of Lee Hall's veranda. I sat on its wide stairs and gaped at the looming range of the Blue Ridge, blue indeed, that had awed those first Pilgrim students. The ladder-back rockers lining the porch had to be the same ones that Black Mountain visitors John Dewey, Henry Miller, and Aldous Huxley, men in linen suits, had rocked in, dispensing with inscrutable wit what it was like to be brilliant and recognized worldwide. Those rockers murmured, the planks beneath them creaked assent, the sound of the past, all its uncanny falsehood and imagined idea of perfection was hauntingly palpable. In 1941, the college moved but a few miles from the Blue Ridge Assembly to its decidedly more famous, even more notorious, campus at Lake Eden. It was built in the early 1900s by E.W. Grove, often dubbed the father of modern Asheville, the man who built the Grove Park Inn. Finding it was not so easy. The highway marker gives only the murkiest directions for how to get there. What does 3 miles northwest mean, anyhow, unless you're a crow? Furthermore, the marker does not stipulate which of the two Black Mountain campus it refers to. Nevertheless, I drove the maze of roads off Highway 70 until I finally found Lake Eden Road, and not long after, Lake Eden itself. I recognized the campus at once from the various photographs I had seen in Duberman's book and elsewhere. It was by then Camp Rockmon, a Christian summer camp for boys in sight of the Lake Eden Arts Festival. It was early December. The place was seemingly abandoned. I wandered about in a stupor. I found the roundhouse and the quiet house, a small stone building, the college's de facto chapel, built in memory of Ted Dreyer's son Mark. Dreyer was one of Rice's original band from Rollins. Mark was killed in an automobile accident on the campus. I entered the dining hall, a rustic beamed window-lined room with a fireplace, polished wooden floors, and wagon wheel chandeliers. In this very room, the absolute first happening in 1952 was staged. An extravagant event owing much to Dadaism, the Yi Jing, and Mary Caroline Richards' translation of Artaud's The Theater and Its Double. It charted the future to this day of wildly collaborative, multimedia, improvisational performance art, and it dramatically influenced an entire generation of performance artists, including Yoko Ono, who became an unapologetic disciple of John Cage, the mastermind of it all. The descriptions of the happening vary widely, and at this point it's impossible to have any documentary sense of it. The audience was seated in four arranged triangles. Robert Rauschenberg's white paintings hung from the ceiling. Cage perched on a stepladder and read various esoteric texts, including excerpts from Meister Eckhart, then delivered a performance with a radio while Rauschenberg played records on a gramophone and David Tudor played piano. Charles Olson and Mary Caroline Richards read poems. Merce Cunningham, chased by a dog, danced among the audience. Film was projected onto the ceiling, and so it went. Perhaps pedestrian by 21st century standards, but utterly unheard of avant-garde in 1952, especially in a remote reach of the North Carolina mountains. I walked out to the screened porch of the dining hall, sat at a picnic table, and mooned at the range of Cobalt Mountains blackening in stark relief against the sky softening in the 5 p.m. light. The lesser peaks in the foreground were green, floating on Lake Eden in perfect mirrored reflection. The water was still, everything hushed save for birdsong. Day lilies fluted out of the shoreline. Across the lake shimmered the studies building. Its original design, too expensive, too elaborate, had been tendered by Bauhaus founder Walter Gropius and his partner Marcel Breuer. Ultimately, the college opted for a design by A. Lawrence Coker, and the entire building, with minimal professional assistance, was constructed by Black Mountain College faculty and students. Today, the studies building looks more than anything dated, though decidedly in the tradition of the Bauhaus, like one of those boxy experimental houses that cropped up in the early 60s. In 1941, however, it would have seemed space age. In the summer of 1944, Elma Stone, a 23-year-old African-American musician born in Athens, Georgia, with a bachelor's degree from Spelman College, which she entered at age 15 and graduated its valedictorian, and a master's degree from Atlanta University, lived on the Lake Eden campus while attending Black Mountain College for its 11-week inaugural summer session. Stone's visit to Black Mountain occurred 10 years before Brown versus Board of Education, 12 years before Authorine Lucy, another African-American woman, matriculated in 1956 at the University of Alabama for a mere 3 days. While Lucy is generally credited as being the first African-American student to attend an all-white college in the Jim Crow South, it is arguably Stone who initially cracked that unassailable barrier at Black Mountain College in North Carolina. On the sacred ground as well, in the summer of 48, the great inventor Buckminster Fuller constructed his first geodesic dome, though it failed to rise and was christened, anecdotally, the Supine Dome by Elaine de Kooning, one of Fuller's students. The design ultimately was not only successful, but is an architectural staple worldwide. In 1953, also on the Lake Eden campus, Merce Cunningham formed the Merce Cunningham Dance Company, which revolutionized the face of dance across the United States and beyond. In December of 1987, I read an article in Creative Loafing about plans to resuscitate Black Mountain College under the leadership of David Peel, the owner of McDibs in Black Mountain, a very well-known cutting-edge music venue. The purpose, according to Herring, David Peel's partner, was to exploit what BMC was. Not to exploit what BMC was, but to pick up where they left off and bring about what will continue to be. Their docket was truly ambitious, from the wacky to the sublime. Peel and Herring had somehow managed to get Annie Elbers, a virtuoso weaver and textile artist, and wife of Joseph Elbers, the extraordinary Black Mountain artist, teacher, and college rector, to weigh in on the new college. Annie Elbers had widely cautioned, "You can't do those things over. Tell them not to try to copy anything. To do something over to make it better is worse." By the time we moved to Old Fort in 1988, Peel and Herring, the proprietors of BMC Inc., must have had something going, because I still have their Black Mountain College Autumn Bulletin 1988, spanning the months of September and October. Classes, lectures, and concerts replete with concessions, childcare, and overnight accommodations were offered, all at the Lake Eden campus, which Peel and Herring had apparently leased. I don't remember any of this coming off, but I do know that subsequently a large brochure turned up, Black Mountain College, A New Beginning, announcing spring session 1989. Peel seemed no longer in the picture, but there's an introductory note from Mark Herring, president. An ambitious schedule of classes followed, including standards like creative writing, sculpture, and drawing, but also futurology, outsider art, and marginality and culture. It all sounded pretty cool. The faculty bios were fascinating. I scored a meeting with Herring, and he invited me to propose a course to teach for the following session. I was in the throes of a modest obsession with James Agee, particularly Let Us Now Praise Famous Men. At any rate, I proposed a course called Human Divinity. That coupling of words borrowed from Agee in Let Us Now Praise Famous Men. Herring liked the idea And Joan, Jacob, and I were invited to an enormous catered kickoff bash in the Lake Eden Dining Hall. Music, dancing, lights, lavish dishes, chefs prancing about in billowing white caps. For that evening is the remnant molecules of the real Black Mountain College, the only Black Mountain College swirled around us. I was able to imagine myself as part of the mystical ongoingness that truly is Black Mountain. I don't know what happened, but I never heard another thing about the new beginning or from Herring again. That grand party was the end of it. Looking back, it was a happy conclusion for me. I never had to figure out what human divinity is. On a Friday in late April 1992, I was working late in my office at Mitchell Community College when the phone rang. In response to my hello issued the inimitable voice, I can hear it now, announcing, "This is Fielding Dawson from New York City." I almost fainted. Fielding Dawson, one of the truly famous Black Mountain writers, author of some 20 books, had been a household name at St. Andrews, where he had visited repeatedly. His writing, photographs of him, and a few of his collages had appeared in several volumes of St. Andrews Review. He had been at the legendary 1974 Black Mountain Festival. I had been reading his work for years. Wow! What I would find out soon was Fielding's favorite exclamation. Fielding had got my name because at the time of his call, I was chair of something called the North Carolina Writers Network Prison Project, and he was looking for entree into prison work in North Carolina. Because of a visit to Attica Prison, he had become a fire-breathing advocate of prison reform and education, regularly taught writing workshops at some of America's meanest prisons, and he was also chair of the Penn Prison Writing Committee. To recapitulate my relationship with Fielding would take an additional 50,000 words. We became close friends for the last 10 years of his life. He annually trekked to Statesville, stayed with my family at our home, and he and I taught creative writing together at the Statesville Medium Security Prison. My sons, Jacob and Beckett, grew up calling him Uncle Fielding, calling his wife, Susan Moldovan, who occasionally accompanied him, Aunt Susan. Fielding attended Black Mountain from 1949 to 1953, and while there came under the sway of Charles Olson, of whom he's written considerably. One of Black Mountain's greatest, most lasting contributions to the arts occurred under Olson, poet and scholar, the college's last rector, a mystic, visionary, theologian, historian, philosopher, and two-fisted, outrageous maverick and raconteur. At 6'7", 250-plus pounds, his mere presence was astonishing. During Olson's tenure as rector, from 1953 to 56, the literary arts, notably poetry, flourished and took center stage. From this emerged the School of Poets and Poetry, a realized movement, if you will, known as the Black Mountain Poets. These writers in their oeuvre, heavily influenced by modernist sensibilities, and writers like William Carlos Williams, Ezra Pound, Olson himself, as well as Robert Creeley and Robert Duncan, who taught briefly at Black Mountain, noticeably fed into the rise of the Beat Poets, the San Francisco Poetry Renaissance, as well as many of the iconoclastic, often political and politicized literary evolutions of the 1960s. I have before me two facsimile letters written by Charles Olson, who remained at Lake Eden to liquidate the college's assets after it had officially closed. The letters are to a Mr. Jasper Smith, business manager at North Carolina Wesleyan College in Rocky Mount, North Carolina. The first is dated June 8, 1957. In it, Olson proposes that Wesleyan, just being founded, purchase the by then defunct Black Mountain's library holdings of, and I quote, 12,500 to 15,000 volumes. Olson goes on to say, "We inventory it at $18,873.20. As assignee for the benefits of creditors, I am prepared to offer it to you for $12,500. He includes a telephone number Jaspers can call. Black Mountain, 4461. The next letter from Olson to Jaspers, dated July 11, 1957, confirms that the bargain had indeed been struck. Wesleyan purchased the Black Mountain Library for $6,000. Those facsimiles were given to me by Terry Smith, a formidable Black Mountain College scholar, retired from Wesleyan's English department a few years back. Through Terry's influence, a number of Black Mountain poets have visited over the years, signed broadsides of Jonathan Williams' poems, lined the hall. Terry led me through this past March on my way to browse the collection. I was stretched for time and made it through only one cabinet filled with book after signed book, monographs, chapbooks, many of them valuable first editions, from Olson, Dorn, Oppenheimer, Dawson, Creeley, and Mary Caroline Richards. The precise number of that inventory alluded to by Olson in his letter to Jaspers is imprecise, but several thousand of those volumes have been identified by Wesleyan over the years. To quote Terry's final sentence in his essay, "The Black Mountain College Collection at North Carolina Wesleyan College is because we are the fortunate beneficiaries of Charles Olson's business sense," meaning, of course, that he had no business sense. Black Mountain College closed its doors in 1957, 1 year before the death of Senator Joseph McCarthy. Among the American public and academic community at the time, not to mention the rather suspicious Buncombe locals, there was a general lack of interest in Black Mountain. College had no endowment, and in the end, it was unable to recruit enough students for it to remain solvent. And certainly the arch-conservative climate of the 50s, inspired by McCarthyism, was another stake through its heart. Yet to this day, it remains the greatest experimental academic adventure ever launched on American soil. During its shimmering, stormy history, many of the nation's greatest thinkers and artists were in residence or paid visits to Black Mountain. Annie and Joseph Albers, Hazel Larson Archer, Ruth Asawa, John Cage, Jean Charlot, Robert Creeley, Robert De Niro Sr., Fielding Dawson, John Dewey, Aldous Huxley, Galway Canal, Bucky Fuller, Paul Goodman. You know, the list just goes on and on and on. Albert Einstein even dropped by one afternoon. Thornton Wilder was there. I mean, just a fabulous collection of people. Zora Neale Hurston. However, to associate Black Mountain exclusively with this litany of renowned artists and scholars remains one of the chief hazards of its legacy. What makes the phenomenon of Black Mountain stupendous is the fact that apart from its glittering roster, there are any number of famous artists and writers, the ones without names in neon, without international or even national reputations, but who have made prominent names for themselves across every area of the arts, but not just in the arts. Black Mountain produced some of America's most profound innovators in education, science, social work, architecture, urban planning, psychiatry, history, politics, on and on. To research a Black Mountain College alumnus is to stumble upon greatness, but not merely in typically quantifiable ways. They became citizens of blazing social consciences and engagement who put to daily practice what John Andrew Rice imagined for his new college's students back in 1933, inner freedom and judgment and action. In his The Black Mountain book, Fielding Dawson declares, "Forget about the big names." He goes on to say in an interview I conducted with him that Black Mountain had a lot to do with a lot of talented individuals who were really interested in what they were doing, the mystic, the intuitive, the anarchist is much more the fact of Black Mountain. Black Mountain started with pure intellectual curiosity and radical curricular reform, most notably an arts-centered education and a clear focus on the classic master-apprentice paradigm, and it rewrote the history of the self, an opus still unraveling as the endless labyrinth of influence that is Black Mountain branches off into tributary after tributary. Black Mountain was a gorgeous temperamental hybrid, gone before America ever knew it existed. Nevertheless, as Charles Olson proclaimed in a letter to Martin Duberman, there's no end to the story. Her flag flies. And I'm going to close with a poem. I'm going to read one poem. And then if there's questions, I mean, if you can stand it, I mean, I'm glad to answer questions. Okay, I'm going to just take a swig of this whiskey here. You know. Okay, yeah. I'm gonna end with a poem called Certainty. And I just need to tell you this. 1976, Charlotte, North Carolina, hot as fire, my first summer in the South. Joan and I and our friend Jim Plumlee, who was our Vista boss, went to a party. And we were in there all night. And we had parked Jim's car on the street, 8th Street. We came out of the party hours later. The car was just rolling down the street towards us. Certainty. Far from home, penniless food stamps, everything from Goodwill. I live with Joan Carey, a Baptist girl from Tucker, Georgia. For $80, we leased a Charlotte attic across from Detox and Memorial Stadium and worked in the prisons. My family in Pittsburgh wondered what I was doing for no wage and why all the way down in North Carolina like some agitator. Certainty I lived in then made me happier than I've ever been. One tourist August night, 3 a.m., we barged out of a party at the Weavers. Joan and I and Jim, our Vista boss, we had come in Jim's tiny Honda, brown, homely, tires the size of saucers. We were headed for Krispy Kreme up on Independence. The hot donuts now, neon, about to announce yet another epiphany in that enchanted tropical August. Joan was 20. Sundresses I remember like pets from my childhood, and Jim, so young and confident. Inside, they danced to Thelma Houston's Don't Leave Me This Way, setting fire to Hallelujah, the last sacrifice of summer. Hearts and windows shattered across the Queen City. Glad to be together, we stepped into the street toward the car. The night was far from over yet. Up in the huge magnolias, early morning cast its thermal hush upon the revel. The three of us saw it at the same time. Jim's Honda, somehow detached from its station at the curb, rolled down the middle of 8th Street. An automobile inexplicably animated with sinister purpose, as if we'd tripped unwittingly through the scrim, segregating us from that other world where things happen for no reason at all. Jim and I intercepted it, backpedaling as it bulled us toward the intersection until we finally halted it, inches from catastrophe. We looked at one another and laughed the way convicts ambling Huntersville Yard laughed about building 30, 40 years in the penitentiary, guys my age who wouldn't see the streets again until after the sons Joan and I would one day parent had grown into men and left home. Laughed Joan and I exchange all too often when the unimaginable hurdles into an otherwise placid day. The laugh I think of now is fear. Thank you, everybody. Thank you. Thank you for coming. I appreciate it. Thanks so much. I'm glad to talk if we wanted to discuss or have questions or any of this. I know that was probably a little longer than you bargained for.
Did you write that just for us, or that was something you
just
did?
For you, every audience, I just write something special for. I do, yeah.
That was good.
Well, thanks. Joan, do you have any?
Boil it down. What did Black Mountain College give to the people who were there?
To the students, Martin? To the students, well, to the students and faculty, you know. So there were 1,200 people, not a lot, you know, over a span of 24 years. If you hear them tell it, and there aren't that many of them left because, you know, it started in 1933. So if you figure they were coming there as young people, maybe between 18 and 22, those people, most of them are dead. There's no other way to say that. And the others are terrifically elderly. And we just had it where I teach something called the Black Mountain College semester. So we did a whole semester where we spread across campus through all the curriculum, not just literature and art and things like that, but math and science. So we had we had this wonderful semester. We had a lot of people on campus, and we published a lot of stuff, and we had films. And every single Black Mountain College alum who talks about it in this kind of glowing, mystical way. It's sort of like, you know, we talked a little bit earlier about your service, you know. You can be in a room with other vets, and you don't have to say a word because you're other vet. They're vets too. Now, with Black Mountain College alums, they don't have to talk because they've had this, whatever this mystical experience has been. And I don't want to over-mystify it, but it has been over-sentimentalized, and it's certainly been romanticized, but something very extraordinary happened there that's not quite quantifiable. A really prominent scholar, the world's most prominent scholar, Mary Emma Harris, says that she's not so interested in what happened, but why it happened. So why and how did these people convene on this patch of obscure soil in the middle of this precarious time, and all these things happened, and all these tributaries? It's like a starburst. It keeps going off, you know, and the scholarship's just exploding now on Black Mountain College. I think a lot of it is that, you know, my students, I teach a course called Black Mountain College. I think part of it is that they yearn for maybe something that doesn't exist in education, you know, because they're sort of fed up. They feel like it's lockstep. They feel like they've been failed by the education system. And Black Mountain exists as this, you know, this kind of quasar that's still burning out there. That's why it can't be duplicated. It can't be replicated. I mean, how would you get people like, again, Charles Olson and, I don't know, Thornton Wilder and Aldous Huxley and all those people. How did they come to be there in this obscure place? So it gave a whole lot to them. I mean, they all of them went on, those happy 1,200 went on to do really pretty extraordinary things, you know, and raise extraordinary families. And out of Black Mountain came a lot of additional sort of utopian communities, people who left there. A lot of them went to New York to do the New York poetry thing, or San Francisco beat scene and San Francisco poetry renaissance. But some also started intentional communities like Gate Hill and a number of other communities. And also during the time, the Penland School of Craft existed there, John C. Campbell Folk School, Arrowmont, and other like communities, all clustered without knowing about the other. You know, just over the ridge was another community. So something was going down in the North Carolina mountains. I think that defies, I hesitate to say logic, but something kind of mystical was going on. That's how I like to think of it. I mean, if you think of the Left Bank in the 20s, the Lost Generation, I mean, Matisse and Picasso and Hemingway and Gertrude Stein, you know, I mean, holy God, you know, Fitzgerald and Zelda Fitzgerald and Man Ray and all those people. I mean, how the heck, you know, they didn't email one another and say, let's get here. They just, there was some kind of crazy thing going on.
Are they escaping from the rigidity of, like, education?
Yeah.
Like Summerhill came out of that problem.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Henry and I were talking about Michael Rumiker, for instance, who was one of the really wonderful writers who came out of there. He's about 83 or 85 now. He grew up Eastern European immigrant family, Catholic, very rigid, violent, vicious, alcoholic father. Michael was gay. I mean, he didn't fit, you know, he didn't fit in. There was no paradigm for him. He just showed up at the college one day. I mean, literally, he caught a ride with somebody who had caught wind of it. And he just showed up, and he found that, you know, he found that community, the community we're all looking for. Kids are still looking for that community, you know, especially now where you have a lot of kids who are trans kids, gay kids, kids who just don't fit in, this horrifying regime that we're living under. I mean, everybody's a little freaked. So if you can find an umbrella that, you know, if you can find open arms, it seems like, I think that's universal. I think that's timeless. People have always been looking for acceptance. And, it definitely was for people who weren't gonna thrive in traditional educational environment. And again, it was unaccredited, but the people, nobody graduated. You didn't have to graduate. You didn't have to go to class. I mean, the reigning sort of ethic there was that you were passionate about whatever you were passionate about, and you didn't need anybody to tell you. We're going to give you a place to live and work, and we're going to feed you, and you're going to be passionate about your work, and you're going to go to town on it. And that makes sense to me. I know, and that's not for everybody, by the way. It's just not for everybody. Not everybody thrives in that self-driven, self-motivated environment.
Were they taught, or they just were?
Yeah, they were
taught.
No, they held classes. I mean, there were college catalogs. There were the faculty were people, you know, with very learned, you know, PhDs, but they didn't have to go to class. You know, they didn't have to do anything, but the plates were filled, if you will. If you wanted to come and eat of them, you could. And most of them did. And it didn't start out as an art school either. In fact, Andrew Rice said he was especially opposed to starting an art school, but it morphed into but what he wanted was an art-centered curriculum, because he felt like the arts taught people. He wanted to teach the whole person. And he felt like that the arts were a springboard to teach people how to be human in a way, you know.
So I wonder if you could turn this around a little bit. And, I mean, most of us, I think of a college or a school as a place that's for the benefit of the students.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, because it's that's what you do. What if this was a gathering of talented people who wanted to do their thing, and the medium for them to do their thing was to also have students there, but they got to form a community, an interplay among this quote faculty, unquote.
Among the students, Martin, or just?
No, I mean that the real cause for gathering was the faculty. Like, hey, guess what? You could come be in this place with all these other remarkable people. And by the way, we're going to have students. That's how we're going to make it work.
Yeah. That wasn't their intention. You know, it was a college. It was for young people disillusioned with what was rigidity in a lot of ways. But certainly it was also for faculty who were fed up with rigidity too and wanted that kind of open environment. And also because of the Depression, a lot of the faculty were international folks, literally famous, brilliant people who were fleeing the scourge of Nazism, who were delighted to come to America where they could live and work safely, sometimes just bartering their work for a place to live. I mean, it wasn't lucrative at all. During hard times, faculty would go for months and months, sometimes years, and not get paid. There was no endowment. I mean, they had to scrape it together every year. They had to reinvent general operating costs. Ultimately, that's what did them in. They had no... The things that they didn't want to do to carve their identity, paradoxically, that made it great, was also paradoxically what did it in, because it didn't have guys to cut the grass. And
so who gave them the building and the land? Was there a rich person first,
Malcolm Forbes, who was from the Forbes family, he initially bankrolled it, and then one of the founders, Ted Dreyer, came from money. And every once in a while, he would get his family to cough up. And they drove around the country, too. I mean, literally, with their ledger, taking $5 donations and $10 donations. And people could go there if they didn't have the money. So they just didn't. But they were a working farm. Cattle. They sold timber. They grew all their vegetables, so it was self-sustaining, and that was also something I think that was really remarkable at that time. We have other colleges that kind of do that. Berea College in Kentucky, Goddard College is a like-minded college in New England, Warren Wilson College in North Carolina, where the kids, the students, are security, you know, they do everything, you know, which is a great model, you know. I mean, you can grow your food, you can eat your food, and you get a PhD and all of that. I mean, you're a really rounded person. It's not for everyone. It's also not for every parent either, because there are very few parents now who would be willing to send their kid to an unaccredited school. And they wanted to attract African Americans. That was one of their big quests, but they couldn't really do that with any kind of success, because African American kids were just starting to go to college, and their parents did not want them going to an unaccredited college. Nor would my parents either. I would have said, I'm going to go to experimental school and you never graduate. They would have said, you're nuts. You know, we're not going to do that. We're not going to pay for that. But if you start to, if you kind of research just one of their alums, if you were to Google Black Mountain College Project, it's something Mary Emma Harris has, and she has made it her life's duty in work to collect every interview, not just from the people she could get to who were alive, but also children, grandchildren, brothers, sisters. If you look at their stories, they've all become just extraordinary citizens. And I mean, that's what's most important, I think, to become an extraordinary citizen and human, not artist or scientist. But by the way, they also were artists and scientists. It wasn't perfect, though. I mean, it was a madhouse. There was all sorts of crazy things that happened. I mean, you know, you had 1,200 sort of geniuses there, and the faculty were nuts. I mean, Olson, I mean, he was crazy as a hoot owl, for God's sake. You know,
did he
I mean,
start out like as a student and then later he directed.
Mary Caroline Richards had left. She was a poet. She left in 1948 to do, she might have had a Guggenheim or something like that. And they needed somebody to step in, and she knew about Olson, who had a pretty conventional life up to a point. You know, he worked in the government and everything, but he was a genius. I mean, he was an incredible genius. He got the first PhD from Harvard, and maybe it was American Studies or something. I mean, he was just a brilliant guy. And so the other thing is people were free to do their work there, you know. They didn't care about making money the way we care about making money.
I lived in Maine for 9 years, and the next town was Vienna. I lived in Mount Vernon, and so part of our group was Mark Hedden and Carol. I don't know if you heard of Mark Hedden. So he was there, and he was a good friend of Olson. But he's like dementia, but you can talk to him. If you want to come up 4 hours from here, I'll drive you up.
Well, I would love to. I don't think I can do that this trip, but if I were here longer, I would love to.
He's holding on.
Yeah.
But she told me that without Olson, he may not have pursued what his thing was, and Mark got into petroglyphs, East Northeast Indian.
Yeah.
He actually worked for the state of Maine.
Yeah. And Olson was, of course, famously went to the Yucatan to study Mayan glyphs for a while, and on his second sojourn back to, he was just coming back from studying the Mayan glyphs in 51 when he got there, I think, or it might have even been in 48. Amanda, you had your hand up,
yeah,
I think.
And some of it was answered a little bit, but I was thinking about the trajectory of Black Mountain College and about the economics of the country in that time, and I was thinking about the economics of the students, you know, of their economic backgrounds, wondering about that, and also wondering about the freedom when there aren't jobs to take a risk.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when there's a boom and there's a lot of prosperity, you're less free to not succeed.
You're right.
That has to do with it.
Yeah, I think it has everything to do with it, that it was that kind of crazy crucible in our time. I mean, if you think during Black Mountain's tenure, I mean, we have the throes of the Depression, we have World War II, we have McCarthyism, we have the Korean War, the Beats are coming from the West, civil rights is starting to bubble up. They were in really, really intense, intense times. Now, you could say we always live in intense times, but, the Depression and World War II, for goodness sakes, I mean, that was pretty serious. I think people were glad to have that haven. A lot of international people, were there. I mean, extraordinary people. And I think people were really serious about their work and art, that privileged that over, privileged process over product, you know? They wanted to do their work, you know? And they found a place where they could do their work. I mean, that's what we all want to do. I mean, we want to do our work. We want to be left alone to do our work. But the pool of making a living, and how much do you want to make, too? So it was also about compromise, you know? I mean, a lot of them were real purists. I mean, Olson was a real purist when all said and done. I mean, he single-minded about his work. There's a lot of fallout, too. I mean, the families, you know, I mean, yeah. With the risk comes a lot of damage to your family, too, you know. Yeah, it's really, you should get, if you haven't read Martin Duberman's book, it's just fascinating. And now there's a real explosion of Black Mountain College scholarship. I mean, just crazy, you know, lots of PhD thesis, a lot of kids finding out about it, a lot of building up of scholarship, more and more books, more and more monographs and things. Come to Western North Carolina, you know, like all of Duberman's papers are in the Western Regional Archives. I mean, it's just, I mean, it's fascinating. We take, Joan and I were just there with my students. I mean, it's all there. It's, you know, and there are other communities like it, not quite like it, but there are other communities. And it was very threatening too, you know, it was, again, it was commies and people that like blacks and free love and gay people, and they were smoking dope and doing all sorts of outrageous things. So they were really threatened. And it wasn't always a very congenial atmosphere because, again, it was, you know, a conservative mountain community in the middle of the Depression. But they also found ways to cooperate with that mountain community. So one of the things that I've been really interested in is that where it happened in Appalachia. It didn't happen in New York City. It didn't happen, you know, in some urban place. It didn't happen in Europe. It happened in the mountains of Appalachia, and we're trying to claim that, you know, because we claim Penland, we claim John C. Campbell Folk School. How come people go there? Why do they go there? Well, they go there for isolation, among other things, but there's something also, the muse lives there, we like to think, you know. So something's going down. I don't know what, but.
How long did Buckminster Fuller stay there?
You know, he would show up for summers, usually. They had these summer institutes, mm-hmm. So he usually breezed in the summers. He was there in 48, 49, and that's when Cage and Cunningham were there. A lot of people just came for very brief stays. You know, Olson was there. He was in residence there. He was running the show from 53 to 57, but he was there from 51, hitting 51. So, anybody else? Thank you for your attention and your great questions. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for your strong voice, too.
Yes.
Pleasure.
Oh, my pleasure. You bet.